there is no hope unless you can make something out of the life from the bad situation that you are in.
This is Voices on Genocide Prevention from the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. I'm Bridget Conley-Zulkich. Welcome to this week's Voices on Genocide Prevention. This is Bridget Conley-Zulkich. Today, I have two students from George Washington University. One is Zach Hinden, who's a junior, and the other is Makwe Mabior, a freshman who has a rather extraordinary story on how he came to George Washington University. We'll start with Makwe. Can you tell us where you're from originally?
I'm from Sudan, the southern part of the country. That is where I was born, where I was raised for the first 6 years of my life. But I was staying for most of my life in Kenya, in refugee camp called Kakuma Refugee Camp in northern Kenya.
And why did you leave Sudan?
I left Sudan in 1992 because of the war that started in 1983, before even I was born. So the war was between the rebels that were fighting the government that were stationed in most part of the southern Sudan. So the rebels were a bit having the upper hand. So the government was trying to root out where the rebels were getting their support. So one of the things that they did was attacking the villages where they think that these rebels are getting their recruitment, where they are getting their food, where they're getting most of the information about the government troops and everything. So what they did was they attacked most of the villages, and me, I was, I'm a Dinka, and the rebel movement were led by Dinkas. So they started attacking not only the Dinkas, but all the other tribes that were supporting the rebel. So that attack started in 1991, 92, but it became worse in the year 1992. So that year, our village was attacked. We depend on cattle and crops, but mostly on cattle. We were cattle keepers. So our cattle were taken. Some of the crop store that we had were destroyed, and the houses were burned down. So we had nowhere. We had nowhere to survive. That's when we decided that we should move out of this area, because it has been going on for a number of years. 1990, 1991, 1992, it became worse. That's when we decided to move from a village to another part of Dinkaland. We're not really intending to move to Kenya. But when the other part of Dinkaland, which is Bor, was attacked, we moved again to Western Equatoria. It is part of Southern Sudan. But from there, we became entangled between the government, through fighting the rebels and the rebels fighting the government. That area is where you get the capital city of Southern Sudan. It's called Juba. So the rebels were moving out of, were moving toward Juba, fighting the government, and that is where we were pushed out of our village. So life became very hard. Every day there was shelling. We can get airplane bombing the places where the rebels were operating, as well as where the refugees were staying, the IDPs.
And so how old were you when your home village was attacked?
The first attack was in 1990, but we left in 1992 when I was at the age of 6. So when we left, I was at the age of 6.
And then moving from place to place with the war following you.
Yeah, we moved from one part of Southern Sudan to the other.
And who was with you?
First, I was with my two parents, my mother and my father. But when we reached Bor, we lost my mother, so I moved with my mother, my stepmother, and my father.
You became separated from your mother, or she was killed in an attack?
No, she wasn't killed.
Oh, good.
We got separated.
And when you finally made the decision to go to Kenya with your family, what was the camp like there?
It's not that really we made any decision. It was, we didn't even know that there was a country called Kenya. So what happened, we were just being pushed out of Sudan. So until we reached a border, you know that place, we call it by the local people. That local people, they call them Turkanas. So when we were pushed out of Sudan, the refugee I mean, the UNHCR, that was at the Kenyan border, received us. That is when we were aware that we were in Kenya. So the life was actually bad because there was shelling from the government side, shelling the rebels, and the rebels were living where we were staying, because that is the only place that was available for both the rebels and those people that were fleeing away from the fighting. So we're being shelled by the government troops. You can also get some airplanes like the Antwerp, the Mitch, bombing the places. So it was really hard. People were terrified. There was nothing that you can eat. There's no water. And here you are getting fighting from day to day.
And you saw people suffering all around you as well.
Of course, yeah. So you can see children dying of hunger, the old people who cannot move. No, and those, most of the people were depending on cow meals. And what they were being given is just the corn, which they were not used to. So you get a lot of people dying because the diet is totally different from what they are used to. And they could not cope with that.
And their bodies just couldn't take it.
They can't. They couldn't.
So they said there was no decision to flee Sudan. You simply kept running to get away from the war.
And
found yourself then in Kenya.
That is true. By the way, we were not even aware that there's a country called Kenya. It's only when we came to the border that we were told that we were in another different country and we have to adjust the life of that country. We didn't know that there was a Kenya.
So once in Kenya, in a refugee camp, you escaped then the immediate threat of violence. But what were the challenges for you and your family inside the refugee camp?
Well, first, when we arrived in 1992, it was a bit of a relief because here there was no fighting. We were able to get food, water, and you can sleep soundly without worrying about being attacked at night. So the first year that we were there, from 92 up to 1996, life was a bit okay. But after 1996, life changed. One of the reasons was we got other people from different countries coming to Kakuma. So you got some from Ethiopia, from Uganda, from Rwanda, Burundi, Eritrea, Somali. And so the camp became congested. And the few resources that the UNHCR was providing to refugees became scarce. And so we started experiencing shortages of water. Food was not adequate. Material that were given out, like clothes, stopped being given out. They also give us shelter. So it took many times for somebody to get his house repaired or get renewed. So life again become hard. Coupled with the environment in that place is a desert. And where we were is like equatorial forest. So we were in where you can have rain season, dry season, but here it's always dry season, so you get a strong wind, too hot at daytime, at night it's very cold, and you know we don't have good clothes. So first it was good. After some time, it wasn't. Also, you got some of the local people who are just depending on their cattle. When they see has been given food by the UNHCR, they start complaining that why are they being given food and we are suffering just like them. And so at night they would come and rob people with their guns. So again we start hearing the sound of the gun that chases us out of Sudan. And so it is difficult. Up to now when I left, that is the life that people are experiencing.
And how did you manage to get an education within those very difficult circumstances?
It is that very difficult circumstances that forced me to, because here you have no choice. There is no hope unless you can make something out of the life, of the bad situation that you are in. So when we arrived in the camp, from 1992 to 1993, the LWF, the Lutheran World Federation, started building a school for the refugee. So in 1994, I joined its call. So I had to study because that was the only way that I can make something better out of the life that I was in.
And Zach, I want to ask you a few questions now too. You're a junior at George Washington University. Where are you from originally?
I was born and raised in South Florida.
In South Florida. And when did you first hear about Sudan and about the conflicts in the South and also in Darfur?
Well, I used to do speech and debate as an extracurricular activity in high school, and I remember it was probably my my freshman or sophomore year when someone mentioned, we were having a discussion, and someone mentioned the Janjaweed and what they were doing kind of in passing, and I had never heard of the Janjaweed or the conflict in Darfur. So I went home, you know, did some research, and pretty much from that point on, became interested and deeply invested in working for peace in Sudan. It was kind of an interesting time for me, at least, because you know, I'd read about Rwanda and, you know, the movements in South Africa, but this was really something, this was a conflict that was unfolding right before my eyes.
And when you got to George Washington, you started working with a lot of other students on a range of things for Darfur, from what I understand. Can you talk about some of the things that you and other student activists were doing at GW?
Yeah, well, when I got here, there was already a really strong divestment campaign to get the university and just people in general to divest money from those companies that contributed to businesses in the public sector in Sudan. Personally, I worked with another student and published a paper in a policy journal about some policy recommendations for Sudan. But the STAN chapter on campus here was also highly involved in raising money for several public schools in primary education in Sudan. But Bana really kind of hit the ground running somewhere around fall 2006.
And can you tell us what is Bana and what is the project you worked on that brought you in touch with Makwe?
Well, I mean, the answer to the second question is Bana. Bana is an Arabic word, and it means to build or to found or to create. And basically what our organization does is work to match survivors of the human rights crisis in Sudan with scholarship opportunities in the United States. Over the last 2 years, we've built up a network of Sudanese diaspora groups, NGOs, universities, and professionals across the field who have some kind of stake in working for peace in Sudan. So we've used this network basically to maintain a database of students in Sudan who are qualified to further their education at universities in America, but don't necessarily have the resources to do so. And so we use our contacts and basically try and leverage our resources here in the States to make those opportunities a reality.
And why did Bana choose to focus on helping promising Sudanese students get an education? Obviously, there are lots of other projects that you have worked on, but why did you feel that this one was very important?
Well, personally, I mean, like I said earlier, this was something that deeply resonated with me. This wasn't just something out of the history book. I mean, this was happening in real time, and something that, you know, I was tracking since I was, six, 15, 16 years old, in the papers, and it was happening. Particularly, though, Bana really represents a strategic initiative, and the precedent that Sudan poses for a program like Bana to build peace is pretty unique and in that sense profound. But Bana's vision basically is to build a generation of empowered peace builders, and that's not something that's Sudan specific. However, taking a place like Sudan where there's so little infrastructure for civil society, for state governance, for basic infrastructure for peace building and development, taking a place like that from 0 to 60 really isn't a traditional way to go about it. And so Bana, I think, certainly has a lot to maybe prove, a lot of potential to grow in that environment. And of course, if it's successful in Sudan, there's no reason why the model can't be scaled and replicated to other conflict areas as well.
So how did you get word out to students in Sudan, students like Makwe, that there were scholarship opportunities for them?
Well, we tried a lot of different things. I mean, none of us had ever personally traveled to Sudan, so this was, in that sense, kind of a shot in the dark. But basically, over the last 2 years, we've maintained a number of contacts that professionals who work in peace building and development who travel back and forth between Sudan. You know, these include folks who work for the Institute of Peace, ambassadors, folks in the development or field or humanitarian relief, and they were able to disseminate applications and spread word of mouth, basically. But a major help came in from the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, where we got literally thousands of email addresses of folks who are working in the development and peace building in Sudan. And we just basically sent them all applications. And from what we could tell when we corresponded with most of the people who applied to BNA, it seems that most of them heard through word of mouth. Despite all our efforts, that seemed to be the best way to get the word out.
And Makwe, do you remember when you first heard about this opportunity?
Yeah, I remember because I was after finishing my high school in 2004, and because I didn't have money, I stayed out of school for 4 years. So in 2007, almost the end of the year in November, one of my teacher colleagues whom I was teaching together in high school came to me with the paper, the application paper, and there was an essay part. So he came to me asking for assistance. So we sat down, we discussed, we contributed, point through brainstorming. By the end of that, I asked what he was writing on, and he told me that he's a certain scholarship from America.
Mm-hmm.
So after that, I told him that I would like to see the whole application form. So he took me to his house and showed me everything. So it is after that I became interested, but I didn't have time, so it took me another 2 months. It's only in 2008, in January, that I finally applied for the scholarship.
And the scholarship is a full 4 years at George Washington University, with your tuition and housing covered, right?
That's correct.
So, Makwe, you've been here in the U.S. for a few weeks now, just a few weeks, right?
Yeah, for 1.5 months.
How are you settling in?
Well, first it was a bit hard, but now I'm a bit okay because most of the things that I did know in class, outside the classroom, I've been helped a lot by the BNA official and some of the friends that I have come across in this course. So far so good, but it was a bit hard in the first place. Like, I had to miss classes. Sometimes if I get confused about where the room is or where the building is, because I had a map that I used to go around the campus. So it was hard.
Yeah, and it's only been a few weeks.
Right.
I think you'll probably be racing ahead of everyone soon.
I hope so.
Well, we look forward to hearing more about from you, and we'll probably check in with you again to see how the year went. Zach, do you want to tell us, what are BNA's future plans? Are you going to expand this program?
Oh, absolutely. We plan to bring over another 5 students to universities throughout the country. There's a number of colleges that have both expressed interest in reading and reviewing the applications that we'll be sending out for the next fall semester, as well as several who've made palpable financial commitments to a BNA program at their school. So for the next academic year, we plan to bring 5 students and then hopefully 7 after that. And then, it's all reliant on funding and whether or not universities will pick this up, but we hope to expand from there on into the future.
It's a really amazing and inspiring story to hear about students so far apart being able to come together around the possibility of building a stronger future. So thank you both very much for taking the time to speak with me.
Thank you so much for having us.
You've been listening to Voices on Genocide Prevention from the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. To learn more about responding to and preventing genocide, join us online at ushmm.org/conscience.